Hey, this is Andre Traversa. Welcome again to the Cosmic Citizen. And Paula Thompson, I'm sure you are with me today.
Yes, I am.
Good. I, of course, just scared you again by coming in right at the nick of time. But never fear, I am here, and our guest is here as well.
Yay!
And before we introduce our guest, in fact, I'm going to let you introduce him, Paula, because you know more about him than I do. But before we do, I'd like to just remind everybody again that we are having our new Ministry of the Month feature today, and that at the bottom of the hour, right in the middle of the show, we will be hearing again from Mo Siegel, who will tell us a little bit more about truthbook.com. So that is our Ministry of the Month feature today. So, Paula, why don't you introduce our guest?
Well, good morning, everyone. You know, it's my great pleasure and honor to introduce this next guest. I've known him for many, many years, and I have been a great fan of his and an admirer of his scholarship in the Urantia book. I know him as Bay Sarmast. His pen name is Robert Sarmast. He wrote a book about Atlantis, Discovery of Atlantis, and of course it's inspired and based on the teachings of the Urantia book and the story of Adam and Eve, correlating the two places as the Garden of Eden and Atlantis being the same place. And it's fascinating, and Bayes has done tremendous work and scholarship with ancient lore and legends and how the Urantia book correlates with those. He once called Jesus the hero of the myth, and that idea has always intrigued me. So with great pleasure, I introduce my good friend, Robert Bayes Sarmast. Good morning, Bayes.
Good morning, Paula. Good morning, Andre.
Hey, Robert. Well, Robert, why don't we start off by with this question that I asked you on the phone. Well, I mentioned this to you off the air on the phone a few days ago, but C.S. Lewis is one of my favorite Christian writers. He was interested in pagan mythology and how it correlated to Christianity and to Jesus Christ in particular. He said that Jesus was the myth that came true. Do you think there's any truth to that statement? And if so, could you elaborate on it?
I'm sorry, I missed the last part. What came true?
I said, okay, C.S. Lewis said that Jesus was the myth that came true. And would you say that that's a true statement? And if so, could you elaborate on that?
Well, yeah, that's a lengthy topic. I've actually been thinking about doing a book on the subject. Jesus was the myth that, you know, the thing you have to realize is that he did it deliberately. It wasn't by accident. Now, the more I researched ancient mythology of classical civilizations of the past, predating Jesus' time, the more you realize that the masses of different areas were expecting a very particular kind of person to fit the role of their Messiah. And Jesus fit all of them. And he did this by really an amazing way of doing things, shaping his life, shaping his sayings in a certain way as to be able to fit into that mold that they were expecting. So yes, what he says is true, but I don't think really anybody has realized up until this time, and it's because of our vast knowledge, you know, on the internet, the digital age, that we can check out all these past civilizations, see what they were expecting, and then see what Jesus did, and notice that pretty much everything he did was to fit that myth. So when I call him the hero of the myth, I'm playing on the words of Joseph Campbell, call him the myth of the hero. It wasn't the myth. Go ahead.
No, I was just chuckling because that's a good play on words, actually. No, continue on.
Yeah, he there's actually a part in the Urantia book. I'll read it to you to let you know. Let's say, you know, the universe is about to send, you know, Michael, son of God, and they're looking at our planet and they're trying to see how's the best, you know, what's the best way of making the population accept him. Now listen to this quote. It says, "But it is only foolish to attempt the too sudden acceleration of religious growth. A race or nation can only assimilate from any advanced religion that which is reasonably consistent and compatible with its current evolutionary status, plus its genius for adaptation." What that means is that they knew beforehand, before he even incarnated, that it's not going to work. He cannot reveal religion as he knows it. He has to adapt it and modify it and bring it down to a level that the masses can assimilate. And that's exactly what he did.
You know what? Okay, let me play devil's advocate for a second, though.
But before you do that, Andre, some people on the board are saying it's a little hard to hear, so maybe we can all speak up a little bit. And
okay.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay. Robert, let me play devil's advocate for a second here, because you were saying that Jesus, the various civilizations, classical civilizations, were looking for a certain kind of mythical figure or messiah, if you will, and that you said Jesus fit the archetype, or however you want to put it, you know, of what they were looking for in all kinds of different ways. However, having said that, the Erasmus book makes it very clear that Jesus did not fit the Jewish expectation of the messiah. So how do you explain that Jesus did not? I guess the Jews expected a material ruler who would come in and overthrow the Roman government and that kind of thing. So when you're speaking of the classical civilizations, are you speaking primarily of Gentile civilizations?
No, all of them. Every Jesus traveled across the civilized world.
So including the Jews.
Including the Jews as far as he could. Now remember, his statements were so out of the ordinary. We're so wild. We're used to them now. It's very difficult, if not impossible, for people of today to understand how those ancient people in Jesus' time thought and what their world was like. They lived in a very, very different world. Jesus was, without question, going to clash with traditions of the day, you know, obviously including some of the Jewish beliefs. And Gabriel, before Jesus was even born, Gabriel told that to Mary. You know, these people are not going to accept him. They knew that coming in. But what he did was try to modify it, try to do certain things, say certain things, shape his life in a certain way so that at least it would help them along. He was very interested in that. And if you read the section in the Erasmus book where he travels to Rome, he was very, very interested and focused primarily on discussing meeting the Mithraic priests and the mystery religion leaders in Rome. And these would be the same people that would later accept his religion. So he knew very well what they were expecting. And he went in there, he prepared them for his story that he knew would be coming down, you know, would be coming towards the West, towards Rome, and he knew that it would supplant their version of the mystery hero. So what I'm trying to say is his life and his teachings were incredibly advanced for his time. When he said, when your enemy, you know, love your enemy, let's say, that was unheard of in that time. That was absolutely mind-boggling. We still have trouble with that today. 2,000 years ago, it was unthinkable. So his religion was so revolutionary that he had to fit the mold as much as he could so that at least they could accept him, which means that he knew coming in, before he was even born, that there was going to be a compromise, that they could never accept him and his religion the way it really is. And knowing that, he tried to do as much as he could to help them with that compromise and to help them get as much of his teachings as they possibly could assimilate.
Well, that makes perfect sense to me. Hey, you guys, we're still getting complaints on the board that it's hard to hear. What do you suggest we do? Can I talk louder.
Why don't we do this? I three-wayed Robert into the show. Why don't you call us directly?
Okay.
And that way maybe we'll get a better connection. Although I know you don't have a, I know you're talking on a cell phone. You said that's the only phone you've got, right?
Right.
Okay. Well, that maybe let's try to do it this way. I'm going to give you our number if you want to call in.
I have it.
Direct. Oh, you got it? Okay. It's a 646 number. You got that?
Uh-huh. 7168158.
That's right. Just call in that number and we'll see if we can, and I'll call back in as well. So that way, if you can call in directly, maybe we'll get a better connection.
Okay, I'll call
right
back.
Thank you, guys, because I know everybody really wants to hear what you have to say, Bae. So,
okay.
Thanks so much.
I'll call right back.
Okay.
Goodbye.
Okay, folks, so we're going to get you on board here so you can hear everything they're saying, because you know Bae is going to have a lot of great things to say. So, and I want you all to be able to hear, especially you, Ann. You are so welcome. So I know our listeners don't know what's going on, but here we go. Here's Bae. They're back. Hold on.
Is that better?
Hi. Well, it's good
Hi.
For me. We'll wait and see what they say on the board here. I think it's probably a lot better, though.
Okay, I'll talk louder, too.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you so much.
I'm sorry. Am I on the air, Paula?
Yeah, you're on.
Okay, great, great. Okay. Robert, let me...
Well, I want to make a point, though.
Sure, sure.
Robert, based on what you just said. You know, we know also that there were two ideas of the Messiah. And Joseph held to one and Mary held to the other. Joseph held to, there was a whole group of Jews, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's a whole group of Jews that believed that the Messiah's mission was very much spiritual. And Joseph held to the belief that perhaps Jesus' mission was along those lines, whereas Mary, on the other hand, held to the belief that of the king and overthrow, you know, the oppressors and rule in the king of David kind of Messiah paradigm. Wouldn't you agree with that, Bae? So
yes.
So Jesus was really he was playing into the higher myth, actually, the one that said that his was a spiritual mission, which is of course true. His was a spiritual mission. So I just wanted to point that out. I don't think that, you know, this idea, and I'd like you to elaborate on this, Bae, if you could, this notion that we humans have a thought construct. And, you know, that great section where the Midwayer kind of goes into detail about why they had to use the highest human thought forms and all of this, I believe it was, again, it's the exact same principle that Jesus was using. He was plugging into what was already existent so that we, just as you said, so that it could be immediately accessible by us. And the revelation, the Urantia book, does the same exact thing. So
right.
I think it was essential.
It was. Now, I could go over... I was just reading this book that I wrote. Remember the Garden of the Gods book that I wrote, 1998-99. And I went over this one section where I accumulated all the mythological points that Jesus focused on and assimilated into his ministry and into his life, into his career, so that people could believe in him more strongly. Because remember, his message was extremely revolutionary for that time. It's still revolutionary now.
Exactly.
It's still absolutely revolutionary. And I was just absolutely dumbfounded with the number of things that I had found. His entire life before he was even born was shaped by these events. For instance, just to let you know, the ancient world before Jesus' time was very much fascinated by what is generally referred to as the mystery hero. And each of these ancient civilizations had their own version. So in Rome, it would be Attis and Cybele. In Egypt, it would be Isis and Osiris. In Persia, it would be Mithra and Anahita. And it goes on and on. Adonis and Aphrodite. Every section of that ancient world that you look at, these myths existed, and there was a general pattern that they followed. The details were different, but there was a pattern that was extremely similar and ran through all of these myths about the mystery hero, no matter where you went. For instance, one of them was that there would be a bright star in the sky when this mystery hero would be born. And the ancient world generally believed that these shooting stars signaled, actually I have it right here, a quote from the Urantia book. It says, early man regarded shooting stars and meteors as indicating the arrival on Earth of special visiting spirits.
Wow.
So even before he was born, he had already started this assimilation process by making sure that he's born at that time when Jupiter and I can't remember the other one. I think it's Jupiter and Saturn in the constellation of Pisces met, and there was this bright star in the sky, and that just happens to be the time when he decides to incarnate. So right from the very beginning, before he's even born, he's laying down the pattern that he is going to fit what is expected of this coming Messiah or mystery hero or savior or however, you know, those people were expecting him. Of course, he was going to be very different than what they were expecting. And that's precisely why he shaped his life in certain ways that would make it easier for them to accept the absolutely bizarre things that he was saying to them.
Okay, Robert, I want to believe what you're saying because I'm very interested in mythology and I think it's fascinating. But it seems to me like the Aranser book at the very least downplays this stuff. They kind of make it sound a little bit like, well, you know, just a coincidence that the constellation, you know, that the star happened to be, you know, they talk about the myths and fairy stories that the Oriental minds spin. And, you know, it also says in the book that the only prophecy that Jesus deliberately fulfilled was when he rode into Jerusalem on an ass. So if what you're saying is true, it seems like the text, like the authors kind of downplay this a little bit. Is this something that do you think they wanted us to discover for ourselves, and that's kind of why they kind of didn't make it so obvious?
Well, the Urantia book never makes it obvious. As somebody who's put the Adam and Eve section under the microscope and found the Garden of Eden, you know, exactly as it's described, I can tell you that they do not make anything easy. What they do is provide clues. The rest is up to you. And the way it's shaped is for people that have an expertise in one field or another to be able to utilize those clues and reach certain conclusions. For instance, the Garden of Eden, they could have very easily said, well, the coordinates of where the temple stood was, you know, this latitude and this longitude. But they don't. They just give you clues, and you have to put them together, usually requiring years of work before you can use them in a meaningful way or point to some exact latitude, longitude. And it's like that for most things. I believe anybody you talk to, whether it's in the fields of science or mythology or spirituality or whatever, nothing is really spelled out. I put certain things together. You know, I've been doing this for several years, and everything I've come to understand about the age that we live in and what's about to happen and the Garden of Eden and the Melchizedek missions and so forth, none of it was spelled out. It all had to be pieced together. Now, knowing mythology, I can go over, as we talk, since we have 2 hours, I'll go over the number of things that he did and said, because you've just heard a couple of things now. There are dozens and dozens and dozens of them. He was born in a rock cave. Remember, the inn was crowded, so he was born in what used to be a stable, and it's a rock cave. Well, Mithra, which became the leading contender to Christianity, and which was pivotal to the acceptance of Christianity, expected Mithra to be born in a cave. Mithra had 12 associates. Mithra had a final supper. The Last Supper. He was named Joshua, which means the Savior. Now remember, Gabriel told them to name him Joshua, which meant the Savior, which was the mythological name for the mystery hero, the Savior. Mm. There were the Song of Angels when he was born, like Osiris. Just to go over with you, there are so many. The name of his mother, Mary, that was the ancient name of the mother goddess. And he knew beforehand, you know, that Mary would be worshipped and where, you know,
Okay, wait, hold on, let me ask you about that. You said that was the name of the mother goddess? What do you mean? Elaborate on that one. Where's the etymological connection?
Well, the Urash book says that there were several couples that would have fit the bill as far as who Jesus' parents would be. And Gabriel specifically chose Joseph and Mary for certain reasons that they don't elaborate on. But when you know the facts, you start to realize why. It wasn't just because they were in Jerusalem, which was in an area that was traveled by a lot of different continents. I mean, that was one reason, but there was a lot more, and the Urash book does not elaborate. One of them was that Mary was the name of the mother goddess, which would later make it easily, you know, make it easier for the mother goddess cult, which was prevalent.
I've never seen a mother goddess named Mary. I've never seen that. Can you give me? I mean, I've never heard anybody.
Sure, I have it right here. This is an actual quote from a book. It says, "Fathers of the Christian Church strongly opposed the worship of Mary because they were well aware that she was only a composite of Mariamne, the Semitic godmother and queen of heaven,
okay.
Aphrodite Mary, the Syrian version of Ishtar, Juno, the Blessed Virgin, Isis, as Stella Maris, Star of the Sea, Maya, the Oriental Virgin, Mother of the Redeemer, the Morea, or Trinity of Faith, and many other versions of the great goddess." It was prevalent. Now, that's
there's
just
always
one...
some, there's always some variation on the word Mary.
Yeah, there are. I mean, nothing was exact. What he did was take all of these myths, and as far as he could, he tried to match them in his life and his sayings. And as we talk, I'm going to go over more and more until you see just the unbelievable number of things that he tried to match.
It's just astonishing to me. It really is. But you know what? It makes perfect sense. Because when I think about the God that I know, the God that has been given to me from reading the Urantia book, the universe that I know, and the Jesus that I know, they reach us where we are, mm-hmm. as we are. And they use every opportunity to reach us in the most powerful and succinct and meaningful way to us, because we are their beloved children. They could have just dumped a book written in universal language down here on the planet. What good would that do us? They, in every way, and I wanted to bring up a point, Baze, and ask you a question. I want you to go on because I'm so interested in this topic, and our board is just really digging this. But why do you think, in my opinion, I think that many myths come from ancient teachings, perhaps teachings that first started in Dalmatia, where the prince and his staff said, look, you're going to have other bestowals. Other sons will come. And, we know Adam came, and there were probably myths existent at the time for centuries that this would happen. We know that Van probably perpetuated many of these stories himself just to get people ready. So, you know, I think that one thing leads to another. I think there's a basis in truth in most mythology. Yes, human beings spin it and fantasize about it. But as you have pointed out to me, and you're the one that originally really got me to think about this, based on your study of Adam and Eve and the legends, the many, many legends of the god and goddess, which were humanity's way of describing what they were experiencing back then.
That's right. Now, the plot is going to thicken a little bit, and I don't want to confuse people, but most of these myths come from Adam and Eve. The mystery hero that the ancient world believed in was actually a perverted account of the Adamic legend. Now, different races and civilizations had different memories. They remembered him in different ways. But it was basically a degeneration of the Adamic myth mixed in with some of the events from Dalmatia and elsewhere. So when you study the mythology of Sumeria, Mesopotamia mythology, a lot of that comes from Dalmatia.
Wow.
But a lot of the other ones from different areas are directly linked to the Adamic legend, which left a permanent imprint. Now, one of them was Atlantis, which was nearly the Greek version of the biblical Eden.
Mm-hmm.
But there were many more. In Persia, the Garden of Eden was called Paradise, or Paradis, which meant the walled garden. That's where the word paradise comes from, is the Persian Paradis. The Persians believed that they were, some of the descendants of the people that escaped the flood that used to live in the Garden of Eden. Now, you can find this everywhere. You can find it in Egypt. You can find it in Persia. You can find it in Anatolia, in Rome, in Jerusalem. It was absolutely everywhere. That legend never really got lost. It just got really muddied. So the mystery hero and the pagan religions and ceremonies that surrounded these mystery religions, which were absolutely dominant in Jesus' time, they were everywhere, were actually a degeneration of the Adamic legend. Remember, Adam was so-called born at virgin birth. He wasn't born of a woman, and he was born in a rock temple, and he was born under a full moon. That's right. He was born under a full moon. Well, yeah, Adam appeared, right?
Right.
Out of nowhere, in a rock tomb, a rock cave, which would have been the memory of the stone temple of the Universal Father. He was born under a full moon. He was born in the springtime, just when everything was beginning to bloom. All of these things are the universe's way of helping us, with our limited understanding, to accept these supermen, superwomen, that it sends down. Now, where this is all going, and I'm just putting this down now, we'll reach it later in the program, where this is all going and what really interests me about this, besides the matching all these mythological accounts to Jesus' life, is if you know how they work, if you can figure this out, if you understand how they use the mass preconceptions, misconceptions of what is to be expected of the coming Messiah, then you can also kind of figure out when and how the next one is going to happen, because you can bet that they will use the same program. They will wait until the right conditions are met for what we expect.
Wow.
You know, there's something you said, or something else in the book. I wish I knew. Paul, you're always good at looking at quotes, and I wish I knew where this one was. But it says something. It's another one where they sort of downplay it, and they say something like, the ancients never, they didn't. The whole concept of the incarnation of God becoming man was new to them. That's the quote says the thing that they had ideas of saviors being born from virgins, but they didn't really have an idea of God of actually becoming man. So again, that part was new. What I'm sort of pointing out here again is how the book, it's almost like they seem to downplay these things that you're talking about.
They do seem to downplay it. I mean, the fact that Jesus was crucified during the Jewish Passover.
Yeah, they downplay that. They say
that's just a
coincidence.
That. It's just a coincidence, but if you study everything he did, it's like, okay, well, how many 100, 200 coincidences in a row of this man's life?
But I think the reason they downplay that one, though, Robert, is because they're trying to speak, against the doctrine of the atonement. That's probably why they're downplaying that, because the atonement doctrine says Jesus was our Passover lamb and it was our sacrificial lamb and all that.
I see. Well, yeah, that was just one more coincidence. Let me go over some of the other things that he did and said. The thing about multiplying bread and wine, which is what he did, that was a Jewish expectation of what Messiah would do.
Wow.
Specifically, the wine at Cana, making that wine appear, was an extremely powerful chord that he struck for all the mystery religions, because wine was always considered in the ancient world as a gift of the gods. Mm-hmm. Especially Dionysus, the Greek god Dionysus, who made wine appear. Another thing, let's go to the next one. Jesus healed a blind man by spitting on clay and putting the spittle on the man's eyes. Well, wouldn't you know it? That's exactly what the Egyptian god of wisdom thought. That's how he had healed the blind Horus, the son of Osiris, by putting spittle on his eyes. Well, why did Jesus do that? Did he need to do that? No. Why did he choose that method? And had he not traveled to Egypt several times? Did he not know their myths? Oh, yeah, he knew. He was very, very aware of all these myths. And he deliberately fit these things. Some of the popular sayings, some of his sayings and his famous declarations, like, I am the resurrection and the life, that's what the Egyptians had chanted for ages about Osiris. He is the resurrection and the life, the judge of the dead and the light of the world. Those are all from Egypt. He even used the same words. It was the Osirian doctrine that a dying man is like a grain of, quote, wheat, which falls into the earth in order to draw from its bosom a new life.
Wow.
And it's the Osirian texts, which also speak of numerous arites, or mansions, in the blessed land of Father Osiris. So Jesus used mansions. My father has many mansions. In the story of Mithra, there were 12 associates that surrounded him. He, just like Mithra, he performed miracles, he raised the dead, he healed the sick, he made the blind see and lame walk, and he cast out devils. This was exactly what Mithra was known for.
Don't you think that there are biblical scholars, even without the Urantia book, who, have some of them come across these similarities? Because these things are, a lot of these things you're mentioning are in the Bible too.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand that.
I said that even without the Urantia book, okay, I'm thinking that a lot of biblical scholars must understand some of the things you're talking about, because a lot of these things you're talking about are in the Bible too. So I mean, has there been any biblical scholarship on this kind of stuff, on these similarities between Jesus and Mithraism? I mean, I know that there are some atheists who think that Jesus never existed, and they think he was just the Jesus story was just another take on Mithraism. But I'm wondering if there are any Christian scholars or biblical scholars or theistic scholars who understand that Jesus did this, you know, even without the Urantia book's knowledge. Have you come across anything like that?
I haven't, and I've searched. I have not come across it. I don't understand it. As far as I know, this is the first time that we've been able to figure out what he did and how he did it and why he did it. The Urantia book elaborates more, like that quote I wrote to you in the beginning about why he would do that. But, and it's not just some atheists that are using this. It's, you know, it's popularly called the Jesus myth. Okay? It's not some. It's absolutely everywhere. They've jumped on it. They've jumped on this bandwagon, and with good reason. From the very beginning, you know, the priests of Mithra in Rome, when they heard about Jesus' story, what they said to Paul was, you know, there's actually a famous quote on it. I took down from a book. It says the capped one. They called Mithra the capped one. He says they told the apostles and some of the disciples, our capped one himself is a Christian, because the story of Jesus' life was so similar to the legend that they've been perpetuating for already thousands of years about the birth and death of Mithras, that they couldn't even hardly tell them apart. And that's why the compromises took place, because Jesus had deliberately set the stage. But these atheists that have jumped on this bandwagon, and there's multiple books out on this, and they've all used this. They said, look, this story of Jesus is obviously a myth, because practically everything he did and he said, his whole life, is described in myths that predate him by hundreds, if not thousands of years.
So they use that to discredit the story of Jesus, saying, Jesus is just another myth, right?
Absolutely. It's everywhere. Yeah. If you go to the library, if you go to the bookstore, there's probably dozens of books, and it's all over the Internet. Just Google Jesus myth, and you're going to see it everywhere. Now, the Christians, since the very beginning, they haven't been able to figure this out. They do not know why this is. The scholars among them, they study it, they research it, and they see the similarity is astonishing. There's no
That's what I was asking you, though, Robert. I was asking if Christian scholars have seen these similarities, if they said, wow, this is similar to Mithraism, or, you know. But the thing is that I mentioned C.S. Lewis to you at the beginning. He's the one I know of that talked about this the most. I mean, he said that the Jesus rising from the dead was similar to, you know, the pagan gods rising, dying in the winter and rising in the spring, you know, and things like that.
Right.
And I think Jesus, as you said, talks about that. If a grain of wheat has to fall to the ground and die before it
right.
comes. C.S. Lewis is one I knew who understood. The other thing I think is interesting is I would think a lot of Christians would be open to this, because even conservative Christian scholars I know have recognized that, for example, the Apostle Paul, when he was speaking at Mars Hill, he was talking to the Athenians, and he said, you know, I see by your idols here that you're very religious, and I'm going to tell you that you have an idol here to an unknown God. I'm going to tell you who this unknown God is. It's Jesus. But the interesting thing is that he says things like, in him we move and live and have our being. Well, that's a quote from a hymn to the Greek god Zeus. And even Christian scholars I know, I have a very conservative New American Standard Study Bible, and even in the footnotes there, even they acknowledge that. So it's just interesting, you know. Obviously the Christian scholars don't have the information we have with the Urantia book, but I would think even with the information they have, that a lot of them would be able to figure some of this stuff out.
Well, I've yet to read it. Now, the usual explanation that they give, which is really kind of insufficient to say the least, is that the devil planted these myths to confuse us.
Well, that's a really reactionary point of view. Yeah.
That's the prevalent consensus, with Christians. That's their consensus, because they don't have an explanation, because they don't understand that Jesus was deliberately doing these things, saying those things.
You would think that, you know, if we're thinking about Jesus, and let's just pretend like we don't have the Urantia book, but we're going to imagine that Jesus is an infinite being. We know he is. We understand we're Christians. We understand Jesus is an infinite being. Okay, so that means he had a past before he came here. It's always interesting to me that no one imagines or tries to imagine that past that Jesus had before he came here, and what was going on in that past. What did he do to prepare for this mission on this planet? And, you know, it wouldn't be such a leap to go exactly where we're going in this show and imagine that perhaps he prepared for this mission by studying what human beings were doing at the time and thinking and the whole history of humanity and used those, I don't know what to call them, those constructs, that's the only thing I can think of, to, you know, make his mission more effective. I mean, I think it helps to think about Jesus in a logical way, to think about him as an intelligent being who has purpose in everything he does. And purpose before he came here, purpose while he was here, and purpose now, you know, eternal purpose. And what is that purpose? To just ask, what is that purpose? I want to share this quote because, you know, we're right now, our good friend Chris Halverson always wishes everybody Merry Mithras, which of course we know. We're right now in Merry Mithras. And this was a Mithraic holiday. And this quote from the Jesus Papers is from the Life and Teachings of Jesus, paper 132, The Sojourn at Rome. And let me tell you what section it is real quick. It's the first section. It's right before the preamble. It says, "The significance of this remarkable doing can better be understood when we record the fact that out of this group of 32, Jesus taught religious leaders in Rome. Only two were unfruitful. The 30 became pivotal individuals in the establishment of Christianity in Rome, and certain of them also aided in turning the chief Mithraic temple into the first Christian church of that city. We who view human activities from behind the scenes and in the light of 19 centuries of time recognize just three factors of paramount value in the early setting of the stage for the rapid spread of Christianity throughout Europe, and they are, one, the choosing and holding of Simon Peter as an apostle, two, the talk in Jerusalem with Stephen, whose death led to the winning of Saul of Tarsus, or as we know, Paul, and three, the preliminary preparation of these 30 Romans for the subsequent leadership of the new religion in Rome and throughout the empire. So there it is.
Right.
They're talking about this Mithraic connection being
absolutely
all important. All
he, what he did was absolutely genius, and he did it in, you know, he did everything he could to make just that happen, and it did happen. On one hand, he was shaping his life so that they would better be able to accept him, even though his sayings were very different from what they were expecting in some ways. It was an improvement, a vast improvement over what, let's say, the sayings of Mithras. So on one hand, he was shaping his life. On the other hand, he was going to Rome, and he was preparing those leaders to be able to better accept his legend when it reached them. He was working the whole field from the beginning, and nobody knew what was going on.
He was tilling the soil, preparing the soil for the reception of the later teaching.
Let me give you some more examples. When he went to the mountains alone for 40 days, that was playing out the Mesopotamian motif of the lost god, the quote-unquote lost god, where he gets lost, which is, of course, an ancient memory of when Adam went away for 40 days after the fall. Now, so they had to go looking for Adam in those surrounding mountains. They couldn't find him. His disciples, Jesus' disciples, had to go looking for him in the Perean hills, and they weren't able to find him either. When Jesus vanquished the forces of darkness on Mount Hermon, why did he choose to go to this large mountain? Well, it's because he was copying the story of the mythological hero who always met and conquered the rebels on a holy mountain, like Anzu. Mithra was the mediator. Joshua ben Joseph claimed to stand as a link between man and God, the bridge to eternity. Son of Man promised immortality to those who believed in him, just as Osiris bestowed immortality on his followers. He didn't have the same fasting. He didn't require fasting and all those grueling demands that the mystery religions demanded from their followers, but he did require pretty sturdy, some fiery trials from his own disciples and apostles. So like Tammuz, Dumuzi, Baal, Osiris, Adonis, Attis, and the Mithraic bull, Jesus repeatedly escaped the vengeful attacks of his enemies until he was finally caught and murdered. He was nailed on a tree like Attis. He was, women wailed for him like Dumuzi during his crucifixion. He was the suffering God who brought salvation to mankind by preparing the way for his believers, standing as a quote-unquote door to eternity. In his final days, he gave the final supper with his 12 apostles, just as Mithra had done. Do you understand the significance of that? He had a final supper with 12 apostles, which he deliberately set up. That was the exact story of Mithras. He had a final supper with his 12 associates. And he had, what did he do over there during that final supper? The bread and wine ritual, which is extraordinary that he would choose that ritual of all rituals, because that was absolutely prevalent in the mystery religions.
But wasn't it also, it also comes from Melchizedek, from what I understand, from the Ransom Book of Melchizedek. So the Melchizedek instituted communion with bread and wine as well, or from what I remember reading.
Right. What they were trying to do is to change the ancient custom of drinking blood. They changed blood to wine. Okay? Now let me tell you why. bread and wine ceremony was way older than Jesus' time. And it was meant to baptize the initiates in the mystery religions. It baptized the initiates of the mystery religions with the blood of the immortals. So they were bathed in blood at times, usually the Mithraic bull. And there was this huge, disgusting affair in Rome where they would have this Mithraic bull, the sacrificial bull, which you have to know a lot about Mithraism to know what that stood for, but it actually stood for the story of Adam, where he was the sacrificial lamb, the sacrificial bull, whose holy blood, his sacrifice of coming here and dying on our behalf, is what gave us the holy blood, which was the remembrance of the Adamic blood. Okay? So
wow.
The mystery religions had this, and they would actually bring the initiates down into a pit. They would bring the Mithraic bull above, the sacrificial bull, and while these ceremonies were going on, they would kill the bull, and the initiate would be bathed in the blood
right,
of the bull.
Right.
This is all in remembrance of the holy blood, you know, what was remembered as the special Adamic blood. So the grail, or the golden cup, had previously served as a symbolic container for the quote-unquote blood and energy of the great goddess. Now it got changed to the blood of Jesus. Are you seeing the connections of what he did?
Oh, man, it's blowing me away. Washed in the blood, that's all I can think of.
But you know what? It's funny you're saying that. See, again, the Uranser book downplays this again, though, because the Uranser book talks about how primitive it is that we have, you know, that we have, that you had to have, there's no remission of sin without the shedding of blood. They talk about how primitive blood atonement is and all this other stuff. So again, you have to really, like you said, you have to look for clues to find this, because on the surface, you're not going to find this from a surface reading.
No, you definitely are not. And they downplay it, but it's very obvious after you get all the facts that Jesus knew he wouldn't be able to eradicate, let's say, the bread and wine or the blood ceremony. So what was his compromise? Substituted with wine. He didn't try to eradicate these ceremonies. You can't. You just can't. It takes a long, long time.
Yeah.
So all he did was substitute it with something far less grotesque.
And he probably knew that the Catholics would take that and, you know, take the transubstantiation, the Eucharist, and say, this is my body, this is my blood. I'm sure he knew that they were going to do that, but he, you know, figured, well, you know, that was the best we could do right now.
Exactly. And he used that terminology, you know, I am the bread of life, this is my blood, you know, all those things were deliberate. He knew exactly what was going to happen in Rome. He knew that Mary was going to become worship, you know, an object of worship, and that he was going to displace the mother goddess cult, which was always the icon of the mother goddess holding the baby, is so much older than Jesus. It goes way back to the garden. But he knew that he was going to become depicted that way, as the virgin son of Mother Mary. And he did everything for it to happen. And that is why the Vatican now stands directly over what used to be the center of the Mother Goddess cult. These things were not accidental. They were incredibly difficult. What he did was absolute genius. And as far as I can tell, up until today, nobody's really been able to figure out, you know, what he was doing, and that it was deliberate.
How can we, you know, and I have to add, Andre, I think just because you say they downplay it, but I don't think they downplay it. I think they just leave it to us to discover. I think there's quite a different thing. You know, it's like Jesus not telling his family where he was going, and where he had been that 2 years, or when he went on that caravan trip, you know. To not reveal something overtly is not necessarily downplaying it. It's leaving it to be discovered. And to me, these correlations are fabulous.
Reason I say downplay, Paul, is because they say things like, I mean, like for example, they speak so much against the idea of blood atonement. So it you know, it's almost like they're taking our minds away from thinking about blood, you know, in the first place. I mean, they, you know, so that's why it seems,
well,
it's almost,
they downplay blood atonement, but they don't downplay the correlation between our existing beliefs and our existing mythology and how the universe might use that to reach us, and just as Bayes has pointed out, to upstep those concepts to a higher concept. To me, Bayes, this is so crucial. They are such geniuses. I mean, we are so lowly in our thought processes. We can't imagine what they have at their disposal to use for our benefit, and the intelligence, their intelligence being the number one thing. I mean, these beings are so bright and so eternal. We can't even imagine what it feels like to have trillions of years of experience with these very things, to understand how do we get humans on a world like this that is isolated. They have not had the benefit of contact, regular contact with other worldly personalities. How do we help them begin to look up and see realities that are beyond this world, even beyond what they can see around them in 10 feet? You know what I mean?
Right.
But they know how to do it.
Let me give you another example which correlates with what you're saying. I wrote in the book, if the story of Jesus' birth and miraculous life were not enough to convince the world that he was indeed the Savior, the story of his death and resurrection completed the necessary picture. The persecuted and suffering God had been caught. That's Jesus. Now remember, the mystery hero was seen as this persecuted from the very time he was born. Even the story of Jesus having to go to Egypt to escape the wrath of Herod was a part of the mystery hero story.
Wow.
Now, the story in Mesopotamia was the suffering and persecuted god, Dumuzi, who voluntarily went to his death. Right? The story in Rome was that Attis was betrayed by a man and Attis was nailed to a tree, just like Jesus, okay? Now, the man who betrayed Attis later took his own life in regret, just like Judas.
Wow.
Now, listen to this. Listen to this part. Jesus is standing there. He's going to voluntarily go to his death. His apostles are warning him about Judas, okay? And they're telling him that this fate, this very unsavory fate is coming towards his way, right? Now, Jesus knows he has to die to fit that mold. Listen to what he says. Jesus listened to his apostles, but only said, now this is him replying to their request to get out of harm's way. He only said, quote, my friends, nothing can happen to the Son of Man unless the Father in heaven so wills. Let not your hearts be troubled. All things will work together for the glory of God and salvation of man.
Wow. There it is.
No, they don't downplay it.
So you want to take a call?
Sure.
Okay. 805, you're on Blog Talk, the Cosmic Citizen.
Good morning. This is David, Dr. Dave.
Hi, Dr. Dave.
Well, hello. Hi, Bez. How you doing? It's David Bush.
Hi, Dave.
How are you doing?
Thank you. Good. Thank
you. Oh, yeah.
Good.
This is a great show. Very interesting.
Thank you.
As always, just waiting for it to tie into the present day in my personal life as I sit here in California. I was going through all your stuff last night about the updates on your Atlantis project. And am I jumping into too far off base here? But
it's okay by me. I don't know.
Me too. Fine.
Well, then let's just do it. I was curious how all these myths are going to tie into that. Second garden in the which is Cyprus, as I understand what you're doing, what your studies are concluding or at least theorizing.
Okay, what do you mean how these myths are going to tie into that?
Well, are they, I mean, they're from the Cyprus, I guess, a geographical area, but also the time, how they tie into the time of the second garden, the preparation for the, I'm sorry, I'm not making myself clear here.
It's all right. Just rephrase it.
Yeah, I'm going too fast for myself. First, let me say that I just saw a wonderful picture of Bez in the Holy Land holding up a banner of Michael that just really blew me away. And the story.
That's from
that was in Syria. That's Mount Hermon. I found the exact place of the Transfiguration. of where the apostles were praying and they fell asleep, and where Jesus met Kel and defeated them, and I found the exact place. That was a thrilling moment. That's a whole other story.
That's a good
like
one, too.
Yeah.
Well, actually, okay, I guess what I'm getting at is I've been studying the Archangel Circuit a lot lately, or at least looking into it. I wasn't that familiar with it, and this idea of the rock cave and future revelation coming, you know, possibly in the same way. We have to assume that there's a pattern developing, and the pattern that's developed in the past is, you know, a guide for the future. So do you see any of this tied into the concept of the Archangel Circuit that was put into, I guess, actualization when Jesus was on Earth?
I'm not sure. I know. I don't know much about it. I know people are always wondering where it is. I don't believe they put any hints or clues that would enable us to know, unless I'm wrong. I'm not really sure about that. I don't know enough about it. Sorry.
Okay. Well, you know what?
Well, you know, I know that there's an apocrypha in the movement, and Bez, I'm sure you've heard this too, that it's somewhere in Yosemite. The angelic headquarters of the planet, and my good friend Steve McIntosh pointed out to me one time that there is a giant crystal field under Yosemite, a natural quartz crystal field, and so that just kind of was intriguing, but it's just apocrypha. I mean, it's not mentioned in the book, obviously, and it's just something that people have talked about. That there's a big old tree in Yosemite called the Grizzly Giant, and it's somewhere near that.
Right, but following up on your question about where it's all leading, let me give you an example. When you study the way that the universe worked to help us better be able to accept the messenger, let's project to the future. For instance, in Islam, they're waiting for the Prophet Mahdi, who will be accompanied by Jesus. Now, isn't it interesting that the Urantia book says that the magisterial mission, there might be a magisterial son accompanied by Jesus? That it's a possibility. And will they use that to convince, or better help convince, the 1 billion plus Muslims in the world that this is what they've been waiting for?
Wow.
This is where all this research is going. That's what I'm trying to figure out. Under what circumstances, what are we expecting these days? What are the Christians, the Jews, the Muslims, what are they expecting? And by analyzing that, can we figure out under what conditions this is going to happen? Because I believe it's imminent.
Well, yeah, go ahead, Bess. I'm sorry.
No, that's all I was going to say.
I was just going to say the timing of it all, too. It seems like if we are looking at patterns that have developed, and we know Melchizedek came 2,000 years before Christ, or Jesus, you know, incarnation, and we find ourselves just by chance and happenstance of being born when we were born 2,000 years after that. I mean, I've often wondered if the pattern doesn't lead us up to this exact time for something going on. I mean, it seems to me, and we talk about this on other I've talked with this about Bez on, you know, on other stuff. There's a lot going on in the world today that just points to unprecedented change, that just very, you know, very little guidance for what's going on. And could it all be coincidence? It doesn't seem like it could be coincidence.
Oh, you know, and that's what...
Are you there?
Hello?
They make, that they don't make obvious that it's... They provide very, very subtle clues, and you really have to put the words under a microscope, because very often what they're trying to say, you have to read in between the lines. They will not come out with it. For instance, the very section where Jesus is talking about the end of the era, and he says that when the end of the age arrives, and I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but I can paraphrase, but he said, when the end of the age arrives, the Father will send you a new and enlarged revelation and an enhanced demonstration of righteousness. Now, that sentence alone is so powerful and is so packed with information, it's unbelievable. On the surface, it seems like it's not saying much, but it's actually saying everything you need to know about the Urantia book. The Urantia book itself is that enlarged revelation. First is saying that when the end of the age arrives, the Father will send you an enlarged revelation of truth and an enhanced demonstration of righteousness. Books can't demonstrate righteousness. That can only
right.
be performed. So they're saying that there's going to be a revelation, which is the Urantia book itself, and accompanied some time after, probably very close together, an enhanced demonstration of righteousness, which is the next visitation. So saying that's what's coming. But
yeah.
when you reverse that, it also means, you know, that since the enlarged revelation of truth has arrived, then the Urantia book itself signals that the end of the age has arrived. You see how one sentence is so potent, and it says so much, but it says nothing on the surface. You might read that a dozen times and not really see anything, but the 13th time, all of a sudden, everything fits in, and you're seeing just what he's saying without saying it.
Yeah, the reason, you know,
okay.
I want to just go back to something.
We have another caller.
Oh, okay, go
ahead.
Okay.
Caller? Okay. Quester, you're on Blog Talk.
Hi there, Paula.
Hi.
I called in because I was prompted to on the chat board, so here I am.
Well, welcome. You were saying such great things on the chat board. I thought you might like to call in and ask Bay some of these questions yourself. But you have, seems to me you have a great knowledge of mythology yourself. So,
I think those who know me and Paula, you know me a little bit, understand the nickname I use, Quester, like just about everybody else who gets taken or captured by the Urantia book. I'm what you might call spiritually hungry and have been for as long as I can remember. And in pursuing that hunger, I found myself trying to better understand mythology at one point, long before I ever discovered the Urantia book. So in listening to the interview underway in this particular segment of Cosmic Citizen, it just seemed appropriate to share some of the understandings, personal understanding I have of the role of that myth plays in our lives. It's a very very important role, and unfortunately a role that I don't think we fully understand. And as I tried to suggest when I first jumped in with some chat on the board, we've lost the understanding of myth because we tend to use myth instead of misconception. When we really want to say this is a misconception, we tend to say, oh, that's a myth.
Right.
And so that prevents us from really grokking, a word I love from Robert Heinlein, grokking what myth is trying to tell us.
Well, yeah, I agree with you. Now, I'm really glad you said this stuff, Dave, because one thing I want to do eventually, and I know that, one thing I want to do eventually is do a couple shows on Carl Jung, who was a real scholar of mythology. You know, he didn't have the Urantia book, he didn't have all these things, but one of the things you're saying here is, you know, Jung said that myths were like collective dreams. Okay, so
yeah, he referred to it as archetypal.
Right.
Themes.
And when I quoted C.S. Lewis earlier saying that Jesus was the myth that came true, C.S. Lewis had a similar conception of myth, that a myth was not a false story or a misconception. It was a story that spoke a different kind of truth. It's a story that bypasses our intellect. It's something that speaks to us directly at a gut level, at a deep psychic level. And actually, I think you can also make a case that's why Jesus, told parables and stories, that he understood the power.
Absolutely.
He understood
absolutely.
The power of story. That story can speak to us in a way that sometimes purely rational concepts can't do.
That's so very true. On the board, one of the things I tried to suggest for consideration was the notion that these archetypes or mythologems, as Joseph Campbell described them, lie somewhat ghost-like deep in our consciousness. We're very much aware of them, and they come to the surface in terms of stories that we know under the familiar name myth. stories of the hero with a thousand faces, as Campbell refers to it. And this kind of ephemeral sense of something deep in our consciousness, the UB, or the Urantia book, introduced to me the notion of the fragment of God on this ascension journey as our guide. And I wonder sometimes whether what Jung calls archetype, Campbell calls mythologem, may not simply be the handiwork of our thought adjuster.
What do you think about
that,
Bob?
And just to finish the thought, that the way in which we bring it forward into consciousness in terms of a story just reflects our best understanding of that thought adjuster's work helping us on our journey.
I think that's such a good insight, Dave.
Well, it is, but excuse me. Remember that they don't have a big piece of this puzzle. The hero with a thousand faces. Hello.
Yeah, I was just wondering who the day was, but as you continued, you're speaking of Jung and Campbell.
Jung and Campbell and many others, but
and others.
What they do is they look. I was talking about this with Andre a few days ago when we first spoke. They and others look at the mythology from around the world. Let's say the mythology of South America, and they look at the mythology of Egypt in what we consider prehistoric times, and they see similarities that cannot be coincidental. And what they infer from that, since they believe that these civilizations were not in touch at that time, which they were, it's just that we didn't know about it, but they infer that since they were not in touch and they came up with extremely similar stories about how creation began, about the story of the flood, about the story of the hero and so forth, they explain that as something that just pops out of human psyche, which is in fact incorrect. Those are based on actual events that left such an impression on history that they reverberated around the world, and they sort of shape-shifted with various civilizations as people assimilated them. But the hero with a thousand faces, there was an actual hero before he became a thousand faces. And that part they don't understand. And yes, there are some things that, for instance, we are designed, quote-unquote, to want someone to revere a superhuman figure. And the Urantia book touches on this. It touches on this.
That's my famous mezuzification tendency.
Right.
Those
who understand mezuzification
know what I'm saying.
Well, here's the thing. Well, I don't want to go there right now. Just a second. The thing is, Robert, what you're saying, Robert, is that this desire to revere a Superman, Robert, comes, correct me if I'm wrong, that you're saying that comes from Adam, right?
Well, no, the Urantia book says that we are designed to look for these beings that are higher than us. And it says that it starts with the planetary prince, and then it's the Adam, an Eve figure, and then it goes all the way up to the creator son and the supreme, that we're designed to look for and to find and to revere and worship these beings. And because they're not here, because of the mistakes that happen here, the tragedies really, that desire has to be displaced with humanity. So it's displaced to presidents and kings and mortals, people that really are not worthy of reverence, much less worship. But because the desire is innate and is so powerful within human beings, they have to find it somewhere. And if it's not kings and presidents, it'll be a pope or it'll be the stars in Hollywood. But you can see it working in us. We need it. We crave it. It has to be there. And we're sort of on a withdrawal because we don't have it here. And so it gets displaced.
it kind
we
of begets.
We have to play our little thing for Truth Book, but before we do, I want to kind of switch back, Robert, before we lose this track, because it is so interesting to me, this notion of where we're going, and I know this is where, you know, Dr. Dave was asking, and that was the track you were on. You were getting ready to kind of talk about how our current myths fit into what's coming up at these wonderful times we're in right now. We might call them the end times.
I'd rather we didn't.
Well, what chilled my bone about what you said earlier is that there are some interesting end-time myths right now, and they've been perpetuated for the last 2,000 years. And
right.
And I also wanted to touch on something else you said about that. That what can we get from a simple sentence in the Urantia book, and what do we know about what's going to happen? Well, the very fact that this revelation is here should tell us a lot. It should tell us that it's the end of an age. And we know from the book itself that at the end of an age comes a judgment. That's a great end-time myth. And I'm not saying that to say that, oh, well, it's going to be negative and horrible, because it doesn't have to be. And we know from a perspective that we humans, you know, Jesus told us, he said, behold, all things are, the old things are passing away, and all things are becoming new. And humans tend to think, wow, that's hard. We don't want the old things to pass away. The old things may be bad, and they may be difficult, but at least we know what they are. And the new things scare us, so we're going to hold on. We're going to resist change, even though the change might be good. And I think that's what we're going to see. We're about to see, as the old things pass away, that a lot of people who are afraid are going to freak out.
And just before, just while you're on the subject, sorry to interrupt, there's actually a part that, a sentence that he said when he's talking about the end times. Jesus said, what the whole world will have to face at the end of the age, each of you, meaning the apostles, will have to face at the time that you face death. But what's interesting is what he said, just what you're saying, Paula, what the whole world will have to face. He knew that it would be difficult, if not impossible, for them to face this new reality coming, that it's going to be difficult, and they're going to have to come face to face with reality at that time.
And find a courage that is transcendental almost, to say, you know what, and a faith, to dig down for that faith, that, you know, the affirmation of Jesus. I have absolute confidence in my Heavenly Father's overcare. To dig down to that place of faith where you say, no matter what happens, what Jesus himself said, what does it matter if all things earthly crash? And, you know, right now we're starting to see some of our systems crash. We don't want that to happen. I don't want that to happen. I want my children to inherit a better world. And sometimes, somebody pointed out to me once, and I'll never forget this, he said, Paula, you know, the worst things that happen in life sometimes are such a blessing in disguise. And this is not something I didn't know, but this is what he went on to say. He said, Now take these catastrophes like the tsunami. He said, we look at that and we say, oh, my gosh, could there be anything worse than that? It is just awful, the human tragedy, the desperation. Oh, it's just, you know, we're wringing our hands. He said, now imagine, though, the people that are experiencing this right now, it is indeed very, very hard for them. It's very hard and challenging and almost beyond human endurance. But he said, these people will build their world better because of it. And future generations will never experience this because of what these people went through. And they'll be better off. And that is such a uniquely Urantia book perspective, really, about evolution, and we all know it. But when you're going through the hard time, it's hard to remember. The changes you make as a result are going to benefit future generations.
Well, and it also goes back to another mythic theme. you know, that something new will rise from the ashes, you know, that something new will rise
right.
from the chaos, from the, you know, that something needs to die before it's reborn.
Right.
And on that point, I think it's important to remember that what people get afraid of when you talk about that kind of change is that the new order or the new age is going to be something completely different and unrelated to the previous one. But indeed, it's just a fuller realization of the values of the previous age. It's built
upon.
Well,
absolutely, absolutely, David. In fact, I said this, given this quote on the air before, and I think it's actually really relevant to what we're talking about today. Jesus says to his apostles. I'm not sure who he was talking to in this part, but he says, I came not to take away that which you had from your forefathers, but to give them the perfected vision of that which they saw only in part. And I would argue that that's true of the Urantia book as well, that the Urantia book didn't come to take away from, I tend to look at this from a Christian point of view because I come from a Christian background, but I love to tell Christians, you know, the book is not here to take away your Christianity, it's here to give you the perfected vision of what your forefathers saw only in part. And I think that's true of all the existing religions. You know, but I think that's what Jesus was doing there. He wasn't trying to take away their myths. He was trying to show them how he fulfilled their myths.
That's right.
And
yeah.
So
well,
we're
all in agreement on that. Huh?
So that's a good time to pop in the interview with Mo and take a little break and come right back. Hang with us, folks.
All right.
You know, Mo, I got to tell you, we don't have much time left, but I want to just tell you, that the first question that comes to mind as you tell me about this is, and I'm a Christian myself, I come from a Christian background, but you know, Mo, you come from a Jewish background, don't you? What got you so interested in attracting the Christian market?
Well, Andre, when I was 15, I spent 2 years in a Catholic monastery, and my mother was Christian, my father was Jewish, and I was a hodgepodge. And I left that Christian monastery having spent 2 years studying Théard de Chardin, which led me directly into the Urantia book. And like so many readers, I'm one of those people that wanted a lot more than what I could get out of current Christianity, but I wanted Jesus in my life. And the Urantia book, with its the teachings of evolution, got me into it first, but the life and teachings of Jesus was so surprising and just transformed my life. And I love the whole book. Single word in that book. This has come into my life a number of times. I'd say at this point, thousands of times. I thank the teachings of the Urantia book for taking him from the religion of Christianity to the living Michael of Nebadon, Jesus of Nazareth.
Wow. It sounds like what you're really going after is people who are dissatisfied with who love Jesus but are dissatisfied with what they're getting at their churches and maybe from the Bible, and they want something more.
Absolutely.
Wow.
That's right.
Yeah.
So
we are back. We're back here on the Cosmic Citizen. That was a little snippet of an interview that I conducted with Mo Siegel a few weeks ago. In a recording studio, and he was referring, he didn't mention it in that particular segment, but he was referring to his website, which is truthbook.com, which he helped to find. And that's a great site for people who want all kinds of comprehensive audiovisual information about the Urantia book. You can go to that, again, truthbook.com. There's all kinds of stuff up there. Paul, maybe you can tell us a little bit about that. Can you give us some examples? The quote of the day is one that's really popular.
Quote of the Day is a free subscription, and you just sign up for it. It comes to your email every day. It's a beautiful quote from the Urantia book matched with a stunning image. I know how hard those guys work on those things. I did it for years, and it's a labor of love, and they just, they're inspiring, and they start your day. It's such a wonderful thing to do to start your day with a beautiful quote from the book. And a stunning image, and it's all free. And everything at truthbook.com was really designed for people who don't know a whole lot about the Urantia book and would like to investigate it and find out about it. So really a great site.
We are talking again with Robert Sarmast, who has done all kinds of research and scholarship on the Urantia book and its relation to ancient mythology. We're talking specifically today about how Jesus fulfilled ancient mythical themes and ancient mythical archetypes. I'm going to stand by what I said earlier, though, and say that the Urantia book downplays some of this. And let me give you another example of what I mean. You don't really get into this so much, Robert, but in the book says, for example, that a lot of the prophecies that in the New Testament that were used by the Christian writers, they used a lot of Old Testament prophecies to try to suggest that Jesus fulfilled these prophecies. And the Ransom book says, well, a lot of these quotes were misapplied to Jesus after Jesus was on earth, and they kind of basically say that he only fulfilled one specific prophecy, which is to go into Jerusalem on an ass. And I realize that you're not talking so much about prophecy, but interestingly enough, I will say this: you talked about, for example, how Jesus fled to Egypt and how that was consistent with some persecuted hero gods and things like that. But the interesting thing is, I find it interesting though, because that also dovetails with the Old Testament, because when Moses was a baby, he had to go to Egypt too. The Pharaoh was trying to kill him. Same thing with Joseph. Joseph fled to, he escaped to Egypt as well. The point I'm making though is the book does seem to downplay some of these things. And again, I know
I've noticed that too, and I don't have a specific answer for you.
I'm not criticizing the Ransom book. I'm just standing what I said about them downplaying some of these things. I think they downplay some of these things. Maybe they do it because, for two reasons. One is because they're trying to help us, so that we can discover them for ourselves. But the other reason maybe they're downplaying it is kind of for the same reason that they know that sometimes people can become superstitious and venerate certain things. I don't know. I mean, I'm just wondering.
I don't know either. All I know is there's dozens and dozens of matches. Let me give you a couple more. While he bled on the cross, nailed to the tree like Attis, the Roman god, and pierced like Dumuzi, Jesus sends for Mother Mary, which was another fulfillment of a mystery myth. The mother goddess had always been present during the hero's final hours. So the dying and bleeding god was found by Mary, just as Adonis had been found by Aphrodite. Attis had been found by Sibel, Osiris by Isis, and Baal by Anis. All of these mother goddess figures had been found. I found a dying god, usually nailed and pierced on a cross. Now, he was crucified during Passover as a sacrificial lamb, and he was even pierced in the side like the Mithraic bull.
See, now that's an example, though. The Passover was an example. I'd be very interested, Paul, if you could look that quote up for us. The section's called Jesus' Death in Relation to the Passover. Because they really do downplay that one. They make it sound like there was no connection at all, that Jesus could have come at any other time.
Yeah, I've wondered about that myself. I don't understand it.
Would you mind looking that up, Paul? Because I'd like to talk about that a little bit. Just so the listeners might be interested to know, just so they can get the author's
perspective. While Paul is looking for that, let me give you a few more. The time of the mystery hero's death, while he was bleeding on the tree, pierced on the cross, or what have you, had been marked by an unusual sandstorm that blocked out the light, just as an evil wind, quote-unquote, had turned a bright day into darkness after the death of the god like Marduk. Wow, another coincidence. Women mourned the mystery god's death just as they had for Tammuz, weeping at the cross. Jesus was wrapped in bandages like Osiris. Like Attis, he was reverently carried into a virgin's sepulchre hewn out of solid rock and was resurrected on the third day following the classic mystery pattern. Now,
here's the quote, you guys. It's from, of course, part four. Paper 186, just before the crucifixion, section 5. It's the paragraph that begins the section. The section 5, Jesus' death in relation to the Passover. There is no direct relation between the death of Jesus and the Jewish Passover. True, the Master did lay down his life in the flesh on this day, the day of the preparation for the Jewish Passover, and at about the time of the sacrificing of the Passover lambs in the temple. But this coincidental occurrence does not in any manner indicate that the death of the Son of Man on earth has any connection with the Jewish sacrificial system. I think there's your key right there, Andre.
Yeah, that's it.
Jesus was a Jew, but as the Son of Man, he was a mortal of the realms. The events already narrated and leading up to this hour of the Master's impending crucifixion are sufficient to indicate that his death at about this time was a purely natural and man-managed affair. I think this section, Andre, what they're trying to do is they're trying to get us away from this idea that Jesus was a sacrifice.
Well, yeah, that's what I was saying. That's why I think they downplay this, because they're trying to get this away from the atonement doctrine.
Right, and so, you know, and I think this brings up an interesting point. They, you know, on one hand, they're wanting us to adopt, as Bezos pointed out, adopt and take these stories and these, and interestingly, you know, this was all before the printing press. We have to keep in mind, I had this insight earlier that perhaps part of this was to keep the oral tradition of these myths alive so that the stories had the power to last over the many centuries that they had to last, through an oral tradition, which is how they were passed down in many respects. And so Jesus, of course, wanted to give them the power that they would last, that they would be enduring. But then on the other hand, how do we keep these erroneous notions of sacrifice from creeping in?
I should mention that some of these things that happened, a lot of them he did deliberately. Some of them happened despite Jesus. For instance, yes, it was a natural occurrence, and yet somehow he manages to die on the day of the sacrificial lamb or the sacrificial bull. Isn't that an amazing coincidence? He did not intend to turn that water into wine.
Right.
And yet, he magically multiplies bread and wine just as the mystery hero did. A lot of this stuff happened despite him. It was planned before he was even born. This was an entire design. Let me give you one of my favorite ones. You know, after he dies, and they bury him in a virgin, solid rock tomb, just like the mystery hero. It just happened that this happens. Now, the two former Sanhedrins carry Jesus' body into this virgin tomb because they knew about this? No, but yet somehow it happened. Now, another one is, you know, when he resurrects, he's buried in the tomb, and there's a huge stone wheel that's covering the tomb, right? And he resurrects. And while the agents are there, the solid, you know, stone barrier is rolled away, and the guards run in fear. Now, let me ask you this. Did that stone barrier need to be removed during his resurrection?
Hmm.
No.
Do you know why? No, of course not. I mean, he doesn't need that. You know, it's a physical barrier. It has nothing to do with his resurrection. But, and yet it happens. Well, the reason is that his tomb was opened and found to be empty, just like the story of Attis. That was the story of Attis, that his tomb would be open. But moreover, Dionysus, the Greek god, who had been found among the Maenads after his sudden disappearance, a group of women went to Jesus' tomb and he peered up among them. But there's also a story of the god Selene that assists the resurrection of Dionysus from the tomb. I actually have an image that I found in a book that shows a little angel, a winged angel, sitting on top of, and this is ancient, sitting on top of a barrier on the rock tomb. And the rock, the barrier is rolled away, and the guard is depicted fleeing from the scene. So, since we know he definitely did not need to have that stone barrier removed for his resurrection,
then one has to wonder why did they do that? I want to just get back to I do slightly differ with you on one point, Robert, and it's not a difference that's really major, because I still basically agree with the whole thrust of what you're saying. I agree with you that a lot of this mythology was based on actual historical events, but I don't think all of it was. I mean, some of the stuff you're talking about it was not, I mean, some of these Greek god things and all this, correct me if I'm wrong, they don't have any resemblance to historical events, the rolling away of the stone and all this. So what I'm saying is, the reason I'm mentioning this is because I do think there is still something to the whole Jungian notion that Dave Questor was talking about, of the collective unconscious, the archetypes, that that Jesus was tapping into that there was something, you know, that there were these. I mean, for example, the Urantia book says, and this is sort of a different, Jesus didn't really deal with this, but, you know, the Urantia book says, for example, that every tribe has its forbidden fruit. Well, you know, that didn't come from any, correct me if I'm wrong, that doesn't come from any historical thing. That's just for some reason, that's something that every tribe seems to go towards. I guess the point is that some of these mystery myths, though, while they have some, they definitely have a lot of grounding in history, particularly Adam and Eve and the planetary prince and some of these things, but they also, but some of them also are, you know, just, they just seem to have, I don't know, for some reason they seem to be welling up from the human unconscious, from the collective unconscious somehow. I don't know. You know, I don't know.
Those are religious, you're talking about, like the fruit, the forbidden fruit. Those are, there's a lot of stuff that humanity, while they're evolving in a primitive state, tends to believe in, the ghost fears and stuff. But those aren't mythology. Those are just natural, primitive belief systems. And yes, those are inherent and innate. That's just how, but even that is part of an evolutionary ascent. Even that's a part of a design. It's not just happening.
Sure, oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But I mean,
but we're talking specifically about mythological accounts. So if you think about the story of this, of the guards rushing in, away in fear with this rock tomb, the interest being rolled away, you got to remember at that time, all the Greeks were familiar with these stories. These are all sort of obscure with us today. But in Jesus' day, these were, you know, they had festivals in Greece that lasted for weeks based on these things. And the Greeks, remember, were pivotal in getting Christianity to the Western world. So it was pivotal for him to use these things to make sure that the Greeks have as strong a chance as possible to believe and do what they need to do. So for us, a lot of this stuff is obscure, but believe me, in their day, they were very, very familiar with all of these.
You know, where did that symbol come from? I mean, the stone, the rolling away of the stone, I mean, where did that come from? It didn't come from something that happened with Adam and Eve, did it?
No, that one I can't trace to any, but we do know that it existed before Jesus' time.
Well, yeah, yes, true.
We don't know where that came from. I mean, it didn't necessarily have to come from someplace for him to use it. He just used it for his advantage. Now, why did that stone door roll away if he didn't need that to be rolled away for him to resurrect?
I'm just saying that they're both true. I think the historical and the psychological things are both true. I think that you're right that there's a lot of the stuff, a lot of mythology comes from historical events, but I think some of it also comes from, as I said, you know, just a kind of a certain reaction in the human psyche.
Of course, and you have to know, but you have to have the Urantia book to be able to trace the ones that are based on legitimate, you know, and that's where it serves a purpose. But there is no doubt that it wasn't just Jesus himself. The whole universe was doing this. For instance, the story of a mystery hero was that when he resurrected, when he was crucified, there's a storm, and of course, there's a sandstorm when Jesus dies, and the sky turns dark, and there's a sandstorm when Jesus is crucified, and the sky turns dark. And then, wouldn't you know it, the mystery hero, when he resurrects on the third day, their sun is supposed to be this glorious day when he resurrects, right? Now, here's a quote from the Urantia book. Uh-huh. It looked dark on that day of crucifixion, but it was gloriously bright on the resurrection morning.
Wow.
Okay, all these things cannot be coincidental.
It right. just sounds right. almost like somebody had a premonition. I mean, it's uncanny, really. It sounds like some ancient seer had a premonition and wrote it down as a myth. And well, because we know that Jesus chose to come here shortly after Adam and Eve defaulted. So that knowledge in the universe was existent for many thousands of years before he arrived, even before Melchizedek came. So, you know, it's just uncanny to me, and who knows, it's a great mystery, and one of the beautiful things about the Urantia book is is the questions it makes as well as the questions it answers, and I love that about it. And I want to, you know, if I can, just touch a little bit, Robert, on you wrote a wonderful paper about the magisterial mission, and I was touching on it earlier because we know we're at the end of an age, and we know that the age is a magisterial mission is going to happen. We know that's the next visitation. We know that at the end of the age, a magisterial son comes to judge the age. And you did a wonderful paper where you, you know, just through a process of deduction, came up with a conclusion about what that's going to look like. Can you expound on that?
Yes, that's another instance where the Urantia book is saying something without actually saying it. And I had to piece together multiple clues from across these 2,100 pages. And when you piece them together one by one, they spell out a very specific scenario. And it's a very strong message. But it's almost like it's hidden. Well, why don't they just come out and say it? I don't know why. But they want people to work on it and study it and research it. And they will provide the clues, but it is not on the surface. Very little in that book is. Specifically when it relates to things that are upcoming,
right,
regarding the end of the age. As soon as you get into that topic, everything gets very, very hazy. And yet at the same time, they provide certain clues that absolutely point to a specific set of events. Now with the magisterial missions paper, there's a you have to read it online, really, and maybe you can provide a link, because it's very specific, but it relays a set of clues that tells us that there is going to be a magisterial mission, and the Urantia book spells out a few different ways that these magisterial missions can happen. But on an evolving world where a magisterial son has never appeared, then he has to come in the flesh. He's not born of a woman, but he will appear fully grown and visible and touchable.
Mm-hmm.
He won't be like a spirit figure. He'll actually be in the flesh. And it also spells out through a series of deductions that he'll be accompanied by 12 Melchizedeks, which have to be the same Melchizedek receivers that were in the garden that had to come back after Adam and Eve failed. And one of them is Machaventa Melchizedek. So through piecing
now,
together...
Now, will they be in the flesh, or will they be spirits?
They will not be in the flesh, but they will be visible.
Okay.
They'll be visible, and there's going to be 12 of them, and there's going to be a magisterial son with or without Jesus. Now, because of Michael's incarnation here, there's a possibility that he'll come by himself, or there's a possibility that it'll be the magisterial son by himself, or they'll be together, or any kind of combination. But the Urantia book kind of downplays the possibility that it'll be Jesus himself, because all eyes are supposed to see him, but only spiritual eyes are supposed to see him, and the authors therefore infer that this must happen sometime in the future, which sort of tips you to the fact that it's probably going to be the magisterial son, which is an avonal. It's a divine being, very similar to Jesus himself, to Michael himself, without the creative powers, but of the same source and as divine.
Is there one more possibility, Bez? I'm sorry to interrupt, but is there one more possibility, since the Adam and Eve, since our material son and daughter never completed their mission, that it could be our material son and daughter come to complete their age?
No, that is not given as a possibility. Although they say that the children that were taken off the world at the time of the default may return to continue their genetic uplift program.
Well,
but
they may,
Adam and
the
Eve,
specific Adams and Eves, but suppose we get our new Adam and Eve, who is going to finish the Adamic mission, because it says in the book we're very close, or perhaps we already have in our own experience completed that mission, but it would seem like any age would have the right to have the material son and daughter of the new age present at the time.
They, as far as I've read, they do not give that as a possibility, because these things, when they happen, they only happen once, and they either work or they don't work.
Gotcha.
But because of the hodgepodge of events that happened here, and the number of possibilities as far as who may come back, and because it's a, because Michael himself is the planetary prince now, anything is a possibility. But I've never seen any reference to Adam and Eve themselves coming back to continue their mission.
Well,
they
now
failed,
here's a quote that I'd love to have you comment on, Bayes. It's from paper 93, Machiaventa Melchizedek, section 10, present status of Machiaventa Melchizedek. And I don't know the paragraph. I can't count them because they're not numbered in this one. But it says, about two-thirds of the way down through the section, it says, all these speculations associated with the certainty of future appearances of both magisterial and Trinity teacher sons, in conjunction with the explicit promise of the Creator Son to return sometime, make Urantia a planet of future uncertainty and render it one of the most interesting and intriguing spheres in all the universe of Nevadon. It is altogether possible, in some future age, when Urantia is approaching the era of light and life, after the affairs of the Lucifer Rebellion and the Caligastia secession have finally been adjudicated, we may witness the presence on Urantia simultaneously of Machiaventa, Adam, Eve, and Christ Michael,
wow,
as well as either a magisterial son or even Trinity teacher sons.
Hmm.
Isn't that an intriguing quote?
Well, man, I hope
it's
they're coming
the best,
to a party,
yeah,
and not a judging.
Yeah, it is. I think at this point in time, I mean, from all my research and what's going on, I mean, I saw what's coming to this planet a while back. None of this is surprising me what's happening today, but there's very little doubt in my mind that the UB itself was a signal that we have reached the end of the age, and that it was a sort of preparation manual for those that could use it. It's very obvious to me that something is afoot, and that there is a strong possibility, because the world has really reached a critical mass at this point. The two sides are extremely polarized. And because it's a finite planet and there's really nowhere else left to run, no unconquered or inhabitable continent that we can run to, we're sort of reaching a crossroad.
Mm-hmm.
And there's really nowhere else to go. I mean, we've reached this place where one side or the other has to take over, and one side is degenerating very quickly while another side is evolving very quickly, and I do believe.
Now, when you say two sides, what are you talking about?
Well, the size, the size that follows God, and like the universe said, there's only two classifications of people: those who do Father's will and those who don't.
Okay.
Right.
And they have. They're basically, this world is stuck in between a war between these two sides.
Mm-hmm.
And both of these sides want to reshape the world.
Right.
One of them wants to reshape it to, God's will, and the other one wants to shape it to their own will, which doesn't include God.
Absolutely.
And it's become we've reached a critical mass point where, all the economies and the societies of the world are connected, and not only connected but interconnected, reliant upon each other. We've never in the history of the world had a situation where the falling of a market of one nation could affect the entire planet and bring the entire world down with it. All of them are interconnected. What happens to one happens to the rest. So we've reached a
mm-hmm.
very, very critical and unprecedented era.
Do you think, Robert, that the visitation will occur in the Middle East? The Middle East seems to be a pivotal point for all the previous apocalyptic revelations.
Well, that's very difficult to tell, and that's sort of why this research into mythology became so interesting to me, because if they formed, shaped, molded the Jesus incarnation in such a way that it would fit all these descriptions that the world at that time was expecting, then we can project that they're going to do a similar thing this time. He's, you know, the next visitation is going to be very similar. He's going to say, whoever it is, magisterial son or Jesus or both, they're going to say things that the world is not ready for, just like the Urantia book says things that the world is not ready for. And yet they're going to have to do and say things that will make it easier for the masses to be able to believe them. So the question is, what are the masses, in particular Christianity, Judaism, and Islam? What are they expecting? They're all expecting the Messiah to come. Israelis are still expecting the physical manifestation of, you know, they're expecting the same Messiah that they were expecting when Jesus came. It's not going to be that guy. But what are they expecting? What time? What kind of events? Are they expecting that there's going to be a light in the heaven when he appears? Are they expecting that he's going to, you know, all those myths. What are our myths today? What is Christianity's? For instance, right now Christians have a specific set of beliefs about the things that will happen before Christ returns. They're expecting worldwide wars, famines, and a set of other things. Or earthquakes.
Well, only a small group of Christians thinks that way. I mean, there are a lot of Christians that don't think that way.
Yeah, what I'm trying to say is I'm in the process right now of trying to get a gist of just what is it that they're expecting, you know, and can we gauge how they're going to time? I mean, I'm just personally curious myself. I want to know.
Well, certainly all of Christianity is expecting Jesus to return, but I don't think many Christians are expecting some other kind of son, divine son.
That's very true.
To return, and so that's an interesting point that may be a shock. And you know, it may be also because we humans tend to get confused about these matters. Some other son will come, and we'll think it's Jesus returning because we don't know any better. But we have another caller. Hold on. Try it again here. 514, you're on Blog Talk.
Hello.
Hello,
Diane. Oh, hi. Hi, Baze. This is Diane Lebrecht.
Hi, Diane.
We've met before in Boulder. I just wanted to say congratulations. I had a question for you, Baze. When you said earlier in the program that to you it was going to be imminent, all that you are talking about, I was wondering, my question is, do you think it has any link to do with the Ophiuchus sign? Do you know anything about that?
No, what is that?
Oh, because I was, there's a scientist that are saying the Ophiuchus sign, there's a 13th sign in the zodiac between Sagittarius and Scorpio, and they say that that sign is that when the sun will align with the middle of the center of the Milky Way galaxy with the celestial equator, and they were saying that the signs were that there had to be 3 solar eclipses, and that happened between 1992 and 2012. So they say that the exact time that something will happen on a spiritual, they say it will be the center of the Milky Way, and because of that, it happens only once every 13,000 years, and they said it means that something extremely spiritual will happen. And so I was wondering if all that you were saying that was so interesting and so revealing, if it had to do anything with the Ophiuchus sign. They say it's called the secret sign, the 13th zodiac sign that some people knew of and that our zodiac does not talk about, but that it is there, you know, and they say it's really the center cross between the divine cross and the terrestrial cross. So that was my question, because being eminent, it could mean that it is something for us to prepare, but in the very near future as opposed to in hundreds of or thousands of years.
Yes, what I can tell you is if it's something that's known and if there are large groups of people that know about it, that expect it,
that, let's say there's a million people that wouldn't believe that the actual next Savior or Messiah has come unless he arrives when there is a bright light in the sky. If that's the case, then based on the way the universe acted on the last visitation, I can confidently say that they will either wait until that bright light is in the sky before he comes, or they'll make some kind of bright light appear. They're playing with us. They're not really playing with us, but they are, we're like an experiment, and it's baffling to them about how to get the truth across to us.
But Robert, you know what? I agree with you that a lot of this is done deliberately, okay? But here's another possibility that I was thinking about. Going back to something, let's go back to the sandstorm during the crucifixion and the brightness, a glorious resurrection morning, okay?
Right.
Because what this makes me think of is, there's another Jungian concept that is interesting. Are you familiar with the concept of synchronicity?
Uh-huh.
You know, the idea that sometimes there seem to be these meaningful coincidences that just seem to occur. It's almost as if nature, there was something in nature that was responding to the crucifixion and the resurrection. It's almost like there's some mechanism in the universe that kicks in. In other words, the physical controllers did not have to deliberately make this happen. Maybe there's some mechanism in the universe that responds to spiritual phenomena. It's kind of like when Jesus calmed the storm. You know, he didn't force it to be calm. It just happened at the same time. You know,
let me tell you about that one.
Okay.
That was because of Enlil, the Mesopotamian god who was called the Lord of the Air. Okay, he controlled the winds.
Mm-hmm.
That was an expectation of what this superhuman figure would do. Now, as far as it, I know very little that happens in this universe. That's not by design. The fact that he died on, he was crucified on Passover as a sacrificial lamb, and then there are these, the whole incident with the rock tomb, it just happens that he's buried in a virgin rock tomb, that he rises on the third day, that the door is removed, that the guards run in fear, that Mother Mary is called while he's being crucified, so that the Mother Goddess is there, the fact that it was the sandstorm comes up and the sky turns black, just happens to happen during his crucifixion, and then 3 days later is this glorious light, bright day, just like it was expected for the mystery hero. These cannot be coincidental.
You know, and I have a friend who says coincident, which adds new meaning to the word coincident. It's almost like it becomes more deliberate. And of course, we know a lot of people believe there are no coincidences, and certainly coincidences tend to get our attention. So, you know, again, we have to go back to all things working together for good. It's purposeful, whether it's intended or not. It's purposeful, and
that's
it's to
true.
Our benefit.
Absolutely.
And I have to tell you, because we're coming to the end of our show, that everybody on the board wants you to touch on what's your next great adventure. Are you going to go back to Cyprus? Are you going to continue at some point in the future to look for Eden? Because I know you have a beautiful baby boy. I've heard him in the background.
Yeah.
And you're happily married, and you've kind of taken on a different passion right now. Are you still interested in pursuing finding the garden?
Yes, I'm very, very interested. It's probably, one thing you have to realize about major discoveries is that they often are not sudden. If you look at most of the discoveries, whether it's scientific, archaeological, whatnot, they usually take decades. None of them happen overnight. Now, our project, I was in Cyprus for 3 years. If we would have discovered it right then and there, that would have been considered miraculous, that in 3 years you could make a discovery like that. Of course, I would have loved nothing better. We did find it. But they usually drag on. They usually take 10, 20, 30, sometimes 50, sometimes 100 years
That's the way they usually play. And that also applies to scientific discoveries, medicine or what have you. They usually take time. And with us right now, I mean, we definitely found a perfect match with description of Eden in the Urantia papers. In a way that, you know, because when the information about the Eastern Mediterranean seafloor came, was published in the Urantia book, nobody knew what it looked like down there. We were the first people to actually provide the high-resolution maps of the Eastern Mediterranean seafloor. We built them. We created them from scratch with some of the best geophysicists in the world. So there's no way that the Urantia book knew, for instance, that there was a land bridge that's now sunken that once used to connect the peninsula of Eden to the mainland, which is now Syria. But when we produce those maps, then sure enough, there is a land bridge there. It's about 27 miles wide at its narrowest point, and it happens to be concave, which, of course, it had to be because it was carrying the Great River of Eden. And all these things couldn't be. These are more coincidences, you know, and there's just, I had a whole other set of hundreds of coincidences about the whole Eden adventure. It was the same way. So we did prove that, and it's also a perfect match with Plato's description of Atlantis. And one thing I should note, whoever wrote the section on the Garden of Eden, the physical location of it, was very aware of Plato's description, of the ancient world's description. And even though the word Atlantis is never used in the Urantia book, not once.
That's true.
There's another one for you. You know, they never mention the word. All they talk about is Eden. They leave it up to us to come up with research and figure out that Eden and Atlantis are one and the same. They don't come out and say it. But if you're familiar with this description of Atlantis through Plato's Book of Critias, and you read the Urantia book's description of the Garden of Eden, what's amazing is they formulated the Urantia book's description to provide the only clues that can complete Plato's description of Atlantis. So they don't go over all the things that Plato had already written about. What they do is complete it with a few missing facts that will enable you to put the pieces together and go to that location and find it. Now, where we are right now, let me give you an example of what I just said. The story in Plato's Atlantis was that the garden went down suddenly overnight. And the Urantia book, when it talks about that, it says, the sinking was not sudden. It took several hundred years. So they're actually kind of like whoever wrote it was kind of looking at Plato's description. But anyway, where the project left us was that we found the rectangular valley of Eden / Atlantis. We know that's where the temples, that's where the homes, that's where the civilizations and cities were located. That we found. We found the mainland where it was connected to. We found the isthmus or land bridge that connected it. We even found the central sector. The next stage was to be able to find some kind of physical remains which would validate the theory. That is where we're stuck because that is incredibly difficult. One, because it's deep sea. We're talking a mile down, which makes it incredibly difficult. Most people don't realize, but I didn't even realize how excruciatingly difficult it is to do research in deep sea. We did two expeditions using the world's best equipment, and there were so many problems, it just boggled the mind. I'm writing about it on the blog. I'll go over them later. It's very difficult. There's no oxygen. There's no air. There's no light. It's incredibly high pressure, and our technology right now is sort of primitive compared to what we have to do to get the job done. What we need to do is to be able to sort of X-ray the seafloor, to be able to find the geometric shapes that are under the mud. There's several feet of silt and mud sitting on top of whatever used to be there. We were hoping that there would be something sticking out, but that was not to be. The only way we can validate this is to be able to X-ray the seafloor, and that requires tremendous energies that are not available right now. some oil companies have something that can sort of do it. They drag multiple sub-bottom profilers at the same time, but that would be, you know, a project in multi-million dollars, which we simply don't have. So what we're waiting for right now is a new technology, and there are new technologies coming up every year in DC research. Once the new technology comes up that will enable us to do what I need to do, then we'll pick up on it. Now, whether that happens next year, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, I don't know. If I don't find it, I promise you my son Darian will follow up on it. How's that?
Well, you know what, too, and I think you brought up something that is just so important to me, and we're not streaming right now, but not to worry because the show is archived and people can go and listen to the rest of it. They were, you know, I'm sorry I waited to the end to bring this up because they really wanted to hear this, but I think they'll go and listen to the archive. I know they will, in fact. You brought up a point that is so beautiful to me because the other night I was watching Discovery and there you were. You were on again. The show that you did with Natalie Morales was aired again. And you know, here are these groups over there in Bimini looking off of the coast of South America or wherever. And you're thinking, no, you know. But what you did, my friend, which is so important, is you put people back in the right place. This is where they need to be. We know it. We know this is the cradle of civilization, and we know that this is where they need to look, not in Bimini and
right.
Not in Iceland or wherever, or the, you know, wherever they're looking. They need to look where you directed them towards. And like you said, you may not be the one, but you've got them looking in the right place. And you've laid amazing groundwork for this. And
yeah, we did lay the groundwork, and it, you know, it's now established as one of the major theories about where Atlantis was, and that took some doing. Of course, there were teams of us working on this. There were thousands of hours spent on it, a lot of money spent on it. We did accomplish what we wanted to do. You know, some people look at us not being able to provide the physical clues as a failure, but it's not, because everything that we could do with the current technology at hand, we did, and we did it with very little money. It was all supported by Urantia Book readers, believers. And, you know, we did something with a few $100,000 that people were telling me is going to cost, in the beginning before I tried doing it, they said it's going to cost multi-millions of dollars. You'll never be able to do it. It's impossible. We did it, and we laid it down. We laid down the groundwork. We established it as a theory. It's not going anywhere. Eden is not going anywhere. The remains are not going anywhere. And whether it happens in my life or not, it doesn't matter. We accomplished what we set out to do. It's set, and hopefully we'll get the rest of it done.
And we know the history is there. We know the history is there, just as you said. There's history all over that area, and that's, if we want to look for ancient history, that's where we need to look.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's where they call it the living museum.
Yeah.
You know, as our technologies improve relating to underwater work, there's a whole lot of things that are going to come up from under the waves. So we are basically just riding with the technology. As technology improves to provide what we need to do to finish the job, we'll be on top of it.
That's exciting. It's exciting stuff. And thank you from the bottom of my heart for your devotion.